This evening we bring to a close our discussions of Chumash Shemos. We have Vayakhel and Pekudei. And as we know, Vayakhel and Pekudei are normally looked upon as a review of sorts of Truma and Tetzaveh, what Truma and Tetzaveh represented in the command stages of the Mishkan and Bigdei Kehuna. Vayakhel and Pekudei are the actual preparation stages, the execution stages. That is, of course, something of an oversimplification, as we will see. But the parsha begins, before we get into the Mishkan proper, there are a couple of psukim regarding Shabbat introduces, in Perek Lamed Hei, Pasuk Aleph, and Vayakhel, Moshe says, Eila hadvar mashet tziva Hashem lasososam. But before we get into the Mishkan, Psukim Beis and Gimel are about Shabbos. And Rashi comments, as quoting Chazal, Sheish Yes Yomim in Pasuk Beis, Hikdim Lahem Asaras Shabbos, Tzivui Meleches HaMishkan. Moshe first mentions Shabbos before going on to talk about the Mishkan, Lomar She'eino Docha Es HaShabbos, to teach us that the Mishkan doesn't override Shabbos, the building of the Mishkan, that is to say. So the message we get from the order of the Pesukim is Shabbos first. Shabbos takes precedence. Mefarshim have pointed out that this message also is one that we have heard already, at least we who have read the Torah, in Parshas Kisisa. Hashem says to Moshe, he describes the Mishkan. And then we have Aches Shabsos HaTishmoru, and Rashi, there are also comments from Chazal that the message is that come Shabbos, you have to put aside your building of the Mishkan. And therefore, the question of Beforshim in a sense is twofold. Number one, why is this idea being repeated? Well, to that we could say, last week was what Hashem said to Moshe. This week is what Moshe says to us. Maybe that's not a repetition. But the question that persists is, why is the order reversed? And in order to preface the answer that I would like to take a look at, which I think is very thought-provoking, we must make reference to a well-known discussion that takes place among Rishonim regarding how to understand the historical or chronological order of events as described in these five parshas: Truma, Tetzaveh, Kisisa, Vayakhel, and Pekudei. In terms of content, Truma and Tetzaveh are the tzivui for the Mishkan. Kisisa contains a description, so dominated practically by the Chet HaEgel, and Vayakhel and Pekudei is back to Mishkan. The question is, how are we to understand this reflecting the actual order of events? And here we have a well-known machlokas between Rashi and Ramban. Revolves around the question as to whether we invoke the idea of a muktam umeuchar batorah, the idea which the Gemara mentions in Psachim Daf Zayin, that there are times when the Torah does not preserve the chronological sequence of events as it presents things. There are higher priorities in terms of what orders the parshas in the Torah. Indeed, that's the opinion of Rashi. As far as Rashi is concerned, chronologically, first came the Egel before anything was spoken about regarding the Mishkan. The contents of Truva and Tetzaveh, they're written in the Torah before the Egel, but chronologically they followed the Egel, and certainly Vayakhel and Pekudei. Ramban, in contrast, and faithful to his approach generally with regards to Ein Muktam U'Meucher BaTorah, very reluctant to use it unless there is compelling reason. And here too, says Ramban, things are as they are ordered. Things happened as they were ordered in the Torah. First, they were the tzivui of the Mishkan and Bigdei Kehuna, as we find in Truma and Tetzaveh. Then there was the Egel, which shelved the Mishkan for a while, because we had to recover from the Egel. And then Vayakhel and Pekudei, the original tzivui, came back to be implemented. We may have mentioned in the past, but worthwhile pondering, according to Ramban, there doesn't seem to be much to discuss in terms of the order of the parshas, because that's the order things happened. But according to Rashi, that in fact, chronologically, the Egel came first, if we may ask, Why then does the Torah put Truma and Tetzaveh, the commands regarding the Mishkan and Bigdei Kohuna, why does it place them before the Egel? As if to say, Ein Muktam U'Me'ucher b'Torah is not an explanation. It's an observation. That means we note that the Torah doesn't always preserve the chronological order, but there's yet room to persist and ask, but why? If we may. And although one may say simply, in the sense that the Torah is looking to obscure, perhaps, the potency or the impact of the Chet HaEgel, as if to say, to couch it amongst the parshas, you've got two Gezunta parshas before it about the Mishkan, and two afterwards, and somehow in the middle, maybe it loses some of its oomph. But there's more to say in that regard. Because really the question as to what the Torah writes first is a statement about the worth and quality of Bnei Yisrael. And I'll preface by referring to a statement in the Gemara, Brachas Daf Lamed Beis, where it's a very interesting exchange, so to speak, between the Jewish people and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It relates to the pasuk in Yeshaya, where Hashem says, V'atomer tzion azavani Hashem, v'Hashem shtechani, we read it after Tisha B'Av. Tzion says, Hashem forgot about me. Hashem says, I'll never forget you. A woman would forget her own child before I'd forget you. Ha'tishkach isha ula mirachem ben bitna. Would a woman forget her own offspring? Gam eile tishkachna ba'anochi lo ashkachech. They would be forgotten before I, but I will not forget you. And regarding the words, gam eile tishkachna ba'anochi lo ashkachech, the Gemara records as follows. Hashem says, I'll never forget you, the Jewish people. And being Jewish, we take that with a pinch of pessimism, because there are certain things that we would actually like Hashem to forget about us. We'd like to have it always. And therefore, on the one hand, we thought, oh, Hashem has forgotten us. Hashem says, I'll never forget you. But then we say, oh, well, does that mean you'll never forget anything about us? Perhaps that means that you won't forget the Egel, for example. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, no, the Egel I'll forget. And that's referred to in the words, Gam Eile Tishkachna, because Eile is a watchword for the Egel as it was presented to the Jewish people, Eile Elohecha Yisrael Asher He'elucha Me'eret Mitzvah. So that's encouraging news for us, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying, I'll forget Eile, I'll forget the Egel. So it's all good, but we're still not happy. We're still a little anxious. Because Knesset Yisrael says, well, once you forgot, start to forget some things, then maybe you'll forget other things. Will you forget Sinai? If you forget Egel, will you forget Sinai? HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Va'anochi lo eshkachech. Va'anochi, of course, refers to Anochi Hashem Elokecha. I won't forget Anochi. That's remembered. And finally, everyone's happy. But the question is, what's behind this discussion? At the end of the day, we know Hashem doesn't forget anything anyway. And therefore, what's the meaning of he'll forget the Egel, he'll forget Sinai, yes, no? So the Maharal, in a Sefer Ner Mitzvah, explains that there's a very profound exchange going on here. The idea of HaKadosh Baruch Hu forgetting something or remembering something means, is that how he defines us? As if to say, when he thinks, so to speak, of the Jewish people, that is he mindful of the Egel? Is he mindful of Sinai? And what does that mean? It means that these things represent us, that these things define us. If they do, they'll be remembered when we're remembered. But if not, they can be forgotten. Really, this relates to the very troubling question of the fact that we made the Egel very shortly after receiving the Torah. And there's two ways to look at that. There's the negative way. Well, they're both negative, but there's the condemning way. And there's the mitigating way. The condemning way is to say, 40 days after receiving the Torah, they're already making the Egel. That is an indication or evidence of a fundamental incompatibility between them and the Torah. It's not for them. If it was a good match, it wouldn't come out in Shana Rishona. It wouldn't come out after 40 days. This would be after Shavuos, a few years down the line. You can, but so early on, doesn't that demonstrate that at their very essence, they're not fully compatible? And indeed, those who would detract from the chosenness of the Jewish people will look upon it in that way. However, the truth is, that early mistake wasn't a sign of an essential incompatibility. It was a sign of residue of our behavioral bad habits that we picked up in Mitzrayim. As we know, there was Avodah Zarah going on in Mitzrayim. The Navi Yechezkel talks about it. We kind of put it to the side, but in a moment of confusion, we reverted to a bad habit. But this isn't a statement about us. It's a statement about the fact that we hadn't fully left Mitzrayim. Leaving Mitzrayim would yet be a process of 40 years. And therefore, really the question as to what the Torah puts first after Matan Torah and Mishpatim, it's a statement about the Jewish people. If the Torah would be faithful, so to speak, to the chronological order of events and give us the true Seder in terms of timeline, how things happened, it would be untrue, essentially, because it would misrepresent the nature of the Jewish people. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts the Truma and Tetzaveh first. They haven't happened yet. But this is the first thing you need to know about the Jewish people, because it's truer. They're more compatible with this, essentially, with the Mishkan and Big Tikkunah, than they are with the Chet HaEgel. So it's a very interesting way of the Torah presenting the quality of the Jewish people in choosing the way that it orders events. This is what's behind Rashi's understanding that we say, Ein Mukdam U'Mu'cha B'Torah. But we come back to Ramban, and Ramban does not see Ein Mukdam U'Mu'cha B'Torah. He sees this is the order of events. First the Tzivui, then the Egel, and then back again to the Mishkan. And it seems like we're back on track, and we fully recovered, and everything's like it never happened, and we can pick up where we left off. Says the Beis Halevi, not so fast. As much as we had fundamentally recovered from the Egel, but it wasn't a full recovery to the extent that everything was exactly the way that it was before. Things had changed, and we were to a degree yet under the shadow of the Egel. It wasn't a shadow of destruction. That had been reversed. But it wasn't as if it had never happened. That will yet something will happen that happens in the future. And the way it comes out, says Beis Halevi, is the order of whether Shabbos is presented first or the Mishkan is presented first. Those are atmospheric markers. And he gives a very interesting mashal. He says, you know, when someone, his daughter gets engaged and he starts to have dealings with the son-in-law, so there's different aspects of that relationship, you know, building up to the wedding and beyond. There's the tachlis. Where are you going to live? What parnasa? Will you keep my daughter and the manner to which she's accustomed? Those very business-like discussions. And then there are the much more luxury item discussions. You know, the certain gifts that the customarily the father-in-law buys for the son-in-law. There's the watch, and there's the shas, and there's the... Those are luxury things. I mean, from a watch and a shas, you're not going to make parnasa. So the Beis Halevi says, you can tell a lot about the relationship in terms of what they normally start to talk about. You see, if when they meet, the first question is not about any of the frills, but about taplisticker things, that's a cooler relationship. But you'll get to the other things in the end. If you answer convincingly how you'll make a living, so then I'll give you a watch. But if they open and they start to talk about all these other things, that shows a very warm relationship. So Beis Halevi says, Shabbos and Mishkan really correspond to those two types of aspects of our relationship with Hashem. The fact remains the Jewish people, of course, the full relationship is with everything. But if the Jewish people don't have the Mishkan, they're still the Jewish people. But if they don't have Shabbos, that's an absolute catastrophe. Shabbos is tachlis. You can't have the Jewish people without Shabbos. And therefore, says Beis Halevi, you see how the atmosphere changed between the two parshas. In Kisisa, before the Egel, even for Ramban, it happened before the Egel. But when they speak, what are they speaking about first? The Mishkan, I'll be with you, and it's a wonderful building, and so many more mitzvahs can be done. And then we get to the business side of things, which is Shabbos. That was the warm relationship enjoyed before the Chet HaEgel. once the egel happened, Mishka Mishelt, but when it came back, you see in Bayakha Pekude, it's not exactly the same. It's a little cooler. The first mitzvah was given, Taflis, Shabbos, priorities, the absolutes, before moving on to the Mishkan. So it's a very interesting way, in a sense, the Muktam Umu'uchar of Shabbos and the Mishkan itself tells us a lot about how things were the same again, but not exactly the same. They were the same, but things had changed. That's the very interesting Beis Halevi. Well, still on Shabbos, because there's two psukim of Shabbos, but they contain a great deal. If we look at Pasuk Gimel, so we see that it tells us, I mean, Pasuk Beis is stated generally not to do malacha, and Pasuk Gimel states, Lotuvaru eish b'chomash oseichem b'yom ha-Shabbos, not to kindle a fire on Shabbos. And as we know, starting with Chazal themselves in the Gemara and other places, there's a much discussion as to why the Torah singled out of the 39 malachas, one of which is kindling, Havara, how come it mentioned it separately? We don't have separate mentions of others. The Torah doesn't say don't write on Shabbos. The Torah doesn't say don't build on Shabbos. But it made special mention of Lo Tuvaru Eish. If it's one of the 39 malachas and the Torah has asked them all generally, how come this was Zoche, so to speak, to its own pasuk, to a special mention? And Rashi quotes a couple of opinions with regards to that from the Gemara. But there is an interesting comment of the Michilta, and Michilta is yet from Chazal, the Michilta of Rabbi Shmuel, and the Michilta states that there's an inference here. The Torah says, Lo tuvaru eish b'chomash roseichem b'yom ha-Shabbos. Says the Michilta, the implication is, the Torah is emphasizing, on Shabbos, you can't light a fire, you can't light kindle. Avalata mavir be'erev Shabbos. But on Erev Shabbos, you can. Now, this statement of the Michilta itself needs inspection, because I think we could have worked that out. When the Torah asks malacha on Shabbos, that means if it's not Shabbos, malacha is mutter. And here we have a special pasuk devoted to tell you that even though you can't light a fire on Shabbos, but on Erev Shabbos you can. I know I can. It's not Shabbos yet. What then is the meaning of the pasuk as explained by the Michilta? So there are two very interesting understandings of this Michilta, which are found in a sefer called Ravid HaZahav. The sefer Ravid HaZahav was written by Rav Dov Ber Treibish, who was the Rav in Vilna at the time of the Vilna Gaon. Must have been a very interesting position to be in. But as we know, the Vilna Gaon was the Gaon of Vilna, but he wasn't the Rav of Vilna. He had no official position. He learned all day and all night and had Talmidim and wrote what he wrote, and life has never been the same after him, but he was not the Rav in Vilna, or even of a shul in Vilna. In fact, interestingly, a lot of what is known, we may have mentioned in the past, a lot of what is known as Minag Hagra, the Minag of the Vilna Gaon, was never really taken on in Vilna, because he had his unique way of doing things, but Vilna had its established Minhagim. So the Gaon followed his Minhagim, Vilna followed its Minhagim, and sometimes the two were not the same, but they lived together in perfect harmony, but Vilna did not change to take on the Minhag of the Gaon. A very interesting example, actually, is saying B'Shamer on Friday night, just before the Amida, with all the Kahal says B'Shamer, you may remember it from Chutz La'aretz, or Hasidim here still, B'Shamer. Okay, that's the mainstream Ashkenazi minhag, is to say B'Shamer. The Vilna Gaon is of the opinion that one should not say B'Shamer. And in the shul in Vilna, where he davened, they all said B'Shamer. And he didn't. But he didn't make a fuss. He just kept quiet until they said Kaddish. Which means the person to the right and to the left of the Vilna Gaon, or maybe two places to the right and to the left of the Vilna Gaon, were all saying B'Shamer, and they lived together in perfect harmony. Interestingly, the minhag of the Vilna Gaon actually took off somewhere else. Not in Vilna, but in Eretz Yisrael. And the reason is because in the early 1800s, it was the Ashkenazi representation of coming to Eretz Yisrael was really spearheaded by the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon, concentrated in Yerushalayim, but also beyond. The Hasidim went to Tveria, Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov, the Galil, and but in the south, it was Talmidim of the Gaon. And from a certain point of view, they found a blank slate in terms of Minhag Ashkenaz. There had been an Ashkenazi Kehillah, but it had been really discontinued. And they kind of restarted it. So they were able, in a sense, to set the tone of what's called Minhag Ashkenaz in Eretz Yisrael, alpi the Vilna Gaon. And that's why a lot of what is really mainstream Eretz Yisrael Minhag Ashkenaz is really Minhag Hagro. A classic example would be a Tefillin on Chol HaMoed, or in Chutz La'aretz before a Tefillin on Chol HaMoed, based on the Ashkenazi Poskim, without a bracha, okay? In Eretz Yisrael, not so. That's Vilna Gaon. So, in any case, this is the interesting times of the Vilna Gaon together with the Rav of Vilna, Rav Dovber Treibisch. And back to our question of the Mechilta. What does the Mechilta mean to say by telling me, what news is it telling me when it says that you can light lights on Erev Shabbos? So firstly, says the Ravid Hazov, it could be that the Mechilta is looking to infer actually a remez that not only is the Pasuk allowing you to light lights on Erev Shabbos, but encouraging you to light lights on Erev Shabbos. After all, that in time became a mitzvah of Ner Shabbos is one of the seven mitzvahs d'rabbanan. It's Kavod Shabbos and it's Oneg Shabbos. The Torah doesn't tell you to do it, the Rabbanan do. However, as is often the case, the Rabbanan take their cue from allusions and hints and indications from the Pasuk. And therefore, perhaps, if the Torah went out of its way to tell me not to light on Shabbos, which I know already, which is meant more for the inference of permitting us to light on Erev Shabbos, maybe it's more than permitting. Maybe it's encouraging, and in time that was picked up on and became the mitzvah, actually, of be sure to actually to light lights on Erev Shabbos. You don't want to be in the dark on Shabbos? That's the first interpretation, which itself is very interesting. But the second understands that it really, and the background to why I would need permission to light on Erev Shabbos if it's not Shabbos, it's a very interesting question that is raised. It's a classic question by one of the Rishonim in Masechet Bava Kama. The Gemara there states that with regards to the halachas of Nezikin, if a person causes damage through fire, how are we to look at his relationship to fire? After all, some branches of damages are things the person does himself, personally, bodily. Other branches of damages are done by his property. If his ox gores, that's not him. It's his ox, but it's his property. He's responsible for it. The question is, if a person lights a fire and it spreads, how do we look at the damage done by that fire? Is it like his animal went for a walk and the fire itself spread? Or do we say, no, this is rather more like he himself has affected this damage? With all the attendant halachic ramifications, we're not going to get into the details. That is known in the classic formulation as Esho, his fire, Mishum Mamono. Is it like his property, like his animals? Or Esho Mishum Chitso, is it perhaps like an arrow that he shot? As surely as if he shoots an arrow, he can't say, well, that wasn't me, that was the arrow. No, that's you. Perhaps fire is like that. And indeed, the halacha is in accordance with the view that Esho Mishum Chitso. If you light a fire, the fire spreads, even in your backyard, and it was completely mutter, but you didn't take care of it and it spread, you are considered to be doing the damage that is done, directly and personally. Esho mishum chitzo. It's like shooting arrows. The Nemuki Yosef, one of the classic we shown him in Maseches Baba Kama, asks a rather alarming question. And that is, according to the Gemara, why is it permitted to light Shabbos candles before Shabbos? What is the background to that question? If indeed the halacha looks at a person's relationship to fire, that as long as the fire is going, we look upon that as the person lighting the fire and spreading the fire and rekindling. So if you light a candle on the Erev Shabbos, and it burns for 4 or 5 hours into Shabbos, the halacha looks upon you as lighting a candle for 4 or 5 hours on Shabbos. So how is Shabbos candles permissible? It's a very startling question. Here we have someone objecting to Shabbos candles on religious grounds. And the classic answer of the Nimuki Yosef to this question is, it's true. We hear a very interesting formulation. It's true, the halacha looks upon whatever happens with the fire, that's considered your act. But it all comes back to the time that you lit it. Whatever happens in the ensuing 4 or 5 hours, wherever the fire should go, whatever it should burn, however long it should burn, that entire enterprise is considered you direct. But it all folds back into the moment that you lit the fire. And therefore, says Nimuki Yosef, what that means is if it burns for 5 hours, you are considered to have kindled a candle for 5 hours in the moment that you lit it. Because it all folds back to the time that you lit it, and you lit before Shabbos, that's why it's mutter. So relief for the Jewish people. The good news is Shabbos candles are acceptable, are recommended by rabbis everywhere, and that's the explanation of Nimuki Yosef. So this is a very interesting discussion. Says Ravid Hazav, it appears to me that this discussion preceded the Nimuki Yosef by about 1,000 years. Because that may well be what the Mechilta means to intimate. When it states that when the Torah says, Lo tovaru esh b'chom ha-shoseichem v'yom ha-Shabbos, you can't light on Shabbos, says the Mechilta, but before Shabbos you can. And our question was, well, obviously, it's before Shabbos. You can, not so fast. The question is, a person's relationship with fire, if it continues to burn, we may have thought that's a problem. To that end, the Torah emphasizes, no, only to light the light on Shabbos is a problem. To light it beforehand is mutter, as per the Nimuki Yosef. So indeed, he sees within this drasha a compacted form of the discussion of the Nimuki Yosef himself with regards to Shabbos candles. Okay, so from the halachic discussions of Shabbos, we move to the Mishkan. And I would like to focus for a few moments on two very similar elements in the Mishkan, actually in the Bigdei Kehuna more specifically, and they are the two sets of stones that are worn in the Bigdei Kehuna, what are known as the Avnei Shoham and the Avnei Miluim. And the first time we see them, although they will be reiterated in our Parshas, the first time we see them is in Parshas Truma, which is in Perek Hei Pasuk Zayin. And if we look there, we'll see Rashi's comments, Avnei Shoham and Avnei Miluim. What are Avnei Shoham and what are Avnei Miluim? Where do they go? So the full Pasuk says, again, Perek Kafei Pasuk Zayin, Avnei Shoham, V'Avnei Miluim, La'efod V'Lachoshen. So these two sets of stones are for the Ephod and the Choshen. Now, the ephod, of course, is that apron which is worn, and you have the two sets of stones on the shoulders, and then the choshen is the breastplate, which is also connected, suspended from the ephod, which is its own thing. That's the choshen. And interestingly, although we have four terms mentioned there, Rashi explains that their relationship to each other is actually two and two. As if to say it's mentioned two sets of stones and then respectively told you each one where it goes. So if you could cut up the pieces of the pasuk, you wouldn't have them in a straight line. You'd actually place them as a square because you've got the two sets of stones and then the two locations respectively. what is known as, well, what Kupperman Zatzal used to refer to as ABAB. And similarly here, Avnei Shoham are the first types of stones, Avnei Miluim are the second. And where do they go? The first goes on the ephod, the second goes in the choshen, which, as we know, they do. Okay, so that's a very interesting parshanut point in itself. But lugufer shel inyan, why are they called these names? Why are Avnei Shoham called Avnei Shoham? Why are Avnei Miluim called Avnei Miluim? Now, Avnei Shoham is easier. Shoham is a type of stone. It's like saying ruby or emerald or diamond. I mean, that's the name of the stone, and that's that. The more interesting one, or the one that needs more discussion, are Avnei Miluim, because Miluim is not the name of the stone. Miluim is a quality of the stone. It's a property of the stone. What property is being highlighted here or emphasized with the words avnei miluim. And Rashi explains the reason why they're called miluim. Of course, the word miluim comes from the word malei, full, or to fill. And therefore, says Rashi, back in Truma, al shem she'osen lahem bezahav moshav, in the setting of the choshen, there was a cavity recessed within the gold there. That's the guma, that's the hole. V'nosna evicham lemalos haguma. And then the stone, these 12 stones were inserted to fill those holes. Because they fill the holes, they're called avnei miluim. In other words, according to Rashi, the term avnei miluim should be translated as filling stones. Why are they called avnei miluim? Could be because that's what happens with them. They fill those holes. That's how they're placed in the choshen. That is Rashi's explanation. So far, things are relatively simple. However, Ramban takes issue with Rashi. And he does so, actually, on four counts, but we'll just take a look at one or two of them. Two, actually. So, two of the Ramban's questions are as follows. Rashi, again, to reiterate, Rashi explains that the term Avnei Miluim, why are they called Miluim? Because they fill the holes in which they are placed. Says Ramban, if you look in the Gemara, you will see that that is not the case. Because the Gemara in Maseches Sota, Daf Memches Amud Beis, talks about a very interesting creature, by far one of the most interesting, that were related to the Mishkan and related matters, and that is the Shamir, that special worm that was able to somehow maneuver or manipulate very hard substances without actually removing anything from them. And the reason why they needed the Shamir, if I remember correctly, it's on the list of things that were created Erev Shabbos Ben Hashmashas, the Shamir. It's been waiting, it's been a long time coming. And the Gemara says the problem is, on the one hand, I mean, how are you meant to put the names of the Shvatim on these stones? We have a bit of a conflict. Because on the one hand, the process is referred to as Pituchei Chosam. Pituchei Chosam, which is an expression you may recall from these parshas, Pituchei Chosam, it's like using, you'd use pincers, or somehow that means that it's not another substance that's added, like ink or such like, but rather the name has to be within the stone itself. Okay, well that sounds relatively simple, because carve out the name and you've got the name in the stone, Pituchei Chosam. Says the Gemara, it's not so simple, because the Pasuk also says, Bimilu Osam. And Bimilu Osam means the stones need to be complete. But if they're complete, you can't carve anything out of them. And now, you're stuck. How do you get the names using no additional materials, but taking nothing away? The answer, says the Gemara in Sota Daf Memches, is the Shamir. The Shamir had a way of writing things or making incisions or cracks or whatever it would be without actually removing any of the material. In the same way that says the Gemara, sometimes fruit would crack when it reaches a certain point. Nothing's been added, nothing's been taken away, but a certain line has been formed. And therefore they would guide the Shamir in the form of the names of the Shvatim, and that's how you get your names on these stones. Says Ramban, all other considerations aside, what do you see that the Gemara says in explanation of the word miluim? The Gemara said, you can't carve anything away from these stones, otherwise they won't be miluim, meaning they won't be complete. Says Ramban, you see from here that avnei miluim, the property being alluded to in the words avnei miluim, is not filling stones, but complete stones. That's what avnei miluim means. Well, that's the first question, which is already a very powerful question from the Gemara itself. Secondly, says Ramban, again, contesting Rashi's explanation that miluim means that they fill the holes, says Ramban, because the Avnei Shoham, if you look at the Parsha, the Avnei Shoham which go on the shoulders, they also put into a kind of a recessed cavity. They also filled in the place that they were. So, If they both did the same thing, how come one's called Avni Milurim and the others are called Avni Shoa? Good shaila. And therefore, says Ramban, Milui means complete, and that's what it's all about. Okay, as we can appreciate, we're not silent in the face of Ramban's questions on Rashi. And with regards to the second question, correct to begin there, the second question as to, again, to remind ourselves, if they both fill in the hole, and filling in the hole gives it the name, how come only one of them got the name? Avni Milui. Says Maharal, because there's a difference. I think the Maharal here showed his Yekish side here. I'm not sure how that works location-wise, but you'll see for yourself. Because the Maharal, yes, they both need to fill in the hole, but they fill the hole into different degrees. The Avni Miluim, you know why they're called full? Because they filled in the hole precisely. You put the stone in, it was absolutely flush with the surface. That's called full. But the two stones, Avni Shoam, they were also put in the cavity. But you know what? They bulged out much more. They protruded much more. Says Maharal, that's not called full. That's called overfull. That's not called Miluim. Malay means full. Exactly. Not more, not less. Not late, not early. Not deficient, not too much. That property only exists by the stones of the Choshen. And that's why only they are called Avni Milui, because only they filled, the other stones overfilled. And interesting, to, as some have pointed out, the Choshen Mishpat, which is so much about Mishpat, and justice, and the law, and it's therefore it has this property of the precision of the law. There's no liberal doses here. It's exactly, no more and no less, that's called Milui. With regards to the opening question of Ramban, namely, you see from the Gemara that Milurim is about completeness of the stone, not about the stone filling in a hole. Well, says Mizrahi and Gur Aryeh, there are two terms, or the Torah uses the word Malay twice with regards to these stones. It begins by saying Umileisa, fill in the Choshen Mishpat, and then adds a second term, Bimilu Osam, in their Milui. Says Mizrahi and Gur Aryeh, the primary meaning of Miluim is the first time it's used, Umilei Sabo, you fill in the Choshen, like we said. If it says it again, that's redundant. And that's what the Gemara is picking up on, the second mentioning of the word Bimilu Osam. If it's a second mentioning and it's redundant, so you can darshan it however you want, and the Gemara says it means it's got to be complete, we're okay with that, so is Rashi. But the primary usage of the term Miluim is that it fills in. And so we have an interesting machlokas now, it really in terms of just the translation of how of this term Avni Milurim. Again, for Rashi, Avni Milurim, they are filling stones. That's why they're called Milurim. They fill in those cavities in the gold there in the Choshen. And for Ramban, they are complete stones. And interestingly, this will have ramifications for, I would say, a sister question. Namely, let's come back to the Shamir. In order to get the names on the stones, they would use the Shamir. And the question is, for how many of the stones would they use the Shamir? Again, there's two sets of stones. There's the Avni Miluim on the Choshen, and then there's Avni Shoam on the shoulders. For which of those stones did they need the Shamir? Well, Ramban's position is very clear. Only for this, for these stones on the Choshen. Because again, for Ramban, Milu Osa means it's got to be complete. That's when you need the Shamir. Only the stones on the Choshen are called Avni Miluim, and there you need the Shamir. But the Avni Shoam, on the other hand, are there's no concept of Miluim, there's no Bimilu Osam, there's no reason at all why they could not engrave, even though it would take some of the material of the stone away, just like you'd normally engrave a name into a thing. According to Ramban, the Shamir was used only for the Avni Miluim, hence the name, and not for the Avni Shoam. Rashi, in contrast, is on record as saying, in his Perush to the Gemara in Sota there on Daf Mem Ches, that they used the Shamir both for the Avni Miluim and for the Avni Shoam. And indeed, there's no reason for him not to say that. because according to him, Avni Milum is not about whether they're complete, it's about being set into the gold, as we said. And the truth is, and with this we'll conclude, but it's a very interesting kind of final point, the Gemara elsewhere seems to support Rashi, that all of the stones needed the Shamir. Not only Avni Miluin, but even Avni Shoham. How so? The Gemara in Masechet Gittin, Daf Samaches Amud Aleph, actually describes the way they got hold of the Shamir. It's a very interesting discussion. They first had to get hold of Ashmadai, who's the king of the Shadim, because he's the only one who knew where the Shamir was. So first the Gemara describes how they trapped Ashmadai. And then they had an interview with him, which ultimately ended up quite badly. But in the interim, they were able to get that information for the Shamir, and then describes how they went and got hold of the Shamir. But the point is that all of this was for Shlomo HaMelech, who was about to build the Beis HaMikdash. He needed the Shamir. And the way the Shamir is introduced by the Gemara there is, his advisor said, get hold of the Shamir that Moshe used for the ephod. That's very interesting. That introduction of the Shamir as the worm that was used by Moshe for the ephod seems to support Rashi, because the ephod is where the Avni Shoham were. And according to Rashi, they also needed the Shamir. According to Ramban, the stones on the ephod didn't need the Shamir. How can the Gemara describe the Shamir as what they used to write the names on the ephod? Says Ramban, who raises this question himself, I'm aware of the question, I'm not threatened by it, because the word ephod there, you should know, means the ephod as the setting for the choshen. In other words, the choshen mishpat itself was suspended from the ephod, and therefore I'm prepared to say that when it says they used the shamir for the ephod, it means the shamir specifically for the choshen, but that's called the ephod because it was from the ephod. And in fact, says Ramban, I can prove to you that all things that were suspended from the ephod are all called the ephod. He refers us to the Navi, Shmuel Aleph, when David HaMelech is running away from Shaul, he comes to a place called Ki'ila. And somehow Shaul got wind of this, and David wasn't sure if Shaul was going to come after him, and also if the people of Ki'ila would give him up. Fortunately, he had the wherewithal to find out, because with him was the Kohen Gadol, who had the Urim V'Tumim. And David HaMelech decided that it was worth asking about. And therefore, says the Pasuk says, David said, Hagisha li Ephod. Bring the Ephod. We need to ask from the Urim V'Tumim. And indeed he asked, and the answer he got back was, yes, Shaul knows that you're here, and yes, they'll give you up. So you better leave as quick as possible, which he did. But aside from everything else, says Ramban, what's very interesting is you see that David asked for the ephod. But what does he want? What do you want to do with the ephod? He wants to use the Urim V'Tumim. The Urim V'Tumim were within the folds of the Choshen Mishpat. So when he's asking for the Choshen Mishpat, he says, Hagisha li ephod. That tells us, says Ramban, that even the Choshen, if that's what you're interested in, will also be called the ephod. And thus, if that's good enough for the Pasuk, it's good enough for the Gemara. When it says they use the Shamir for the ephod, it means specifically the Choshen. So these are very interesting discussions we see there. They're interlocked, a number of points here. What does Avni Milui mean? In what way is it different from the Avni Shoham? Is it referring to implications for the Shamir? And so on and so forth. Now, I'd like to move from here to discuss for concluding moments the chief artisan of the Mishkan, and that is Betzalel. And if we come back to our parsha, Perek Lamed Hei Pasuk Vav, he is introduced. Pardon me, Perek Lamed Hei, Pasuk Lamed. Vayomer Moshe el Bnei Yisrael, Ru'u, Kara Hashem B'Shem, Betzalel, Ben Uri Ben Hur, Lemate Yehuda. So Moshe at this point introduces Betzalel to Bnei Yisrael. And together with him is Aliyav ben Achisamach Mateidan. And there are a number of basic questions just in the phraseology of the of the pasuk here. Moshe begins by saying Re'u, see, which is interesting because most things Moshe just says what they are and that's what they are. But here he tells Bnei Yisrael to see Re'u. What's the message of this word Re'u? And Ramban actually talks about this and explains that Moshe really is telling Bnei Yisrael to see in the sense of pay attention. That is to say, to note a phenomenon. Re'u, what has happened here with Bezalel is not in the realms of the ordinary. Because we should remember, there is no natural way that anyone among Bnei Yisrael should be ready or prepared or equipped to make the Mishnah with all the intricacies that are involved. Especially, says Ramban, don't forget, what were they involved in until now? Bricks and mortar, hardly the finer points of art. Which means that seemingly without any training, no one should be qualified to take on the Mishkan. And yet, someone was, and that person is Bezalel. But Moshe wants to ensure that the Jewish people do not let this just wash by them. Re'u, consider Bezalel. Karashem Hashem HaKadosh Baruch Hu appointed him and endowed him with what he needs for the task, as the pasuk goes on to say. So that's the Ramban's comment on Re'u. And indeed, this resonates with the Ramban's explanation of everyone who was involved in the Mishkan, who were referred to as Nisa'o Libo. There are two terms, Nisa'o Libo and Nadvar Rucho Oso. One of them is about the donations, but Nisa'o Libo is not about donating, it's just about being involved. None of them were qualified. None of them had been to Bezalel. And yet, they who came forward? People that wanted to come forward. People who felt, Vayigba Libo Medarchi Hashem, Nisa'o Libo, and they received the divine assistance. Further, says the pasuk, Re'u kara Hashem b'shem, Hashem has called by name. Again, a very specific sounding phrase. It doesn't just say Re'u Hashem is appointed by name. Kara Hashem b'shem, Hashem has appointed him by name, called him by name. What is being emphasized here? Says Malbim, what the message here is that When Bezalel represents the Jewish people in building the Mishkan, it's actually an attainment of a very special quality. We say about people generally, but Am Yisrael specifically, that they have what's called Tzelem Elokim. They're created Tzelem Elokim, in the godly image. And the image means an aspect of emulation. We talk about it as surely as an image is a physical likeness, but if it's an image of something not physical, it means it's a property of emulation. And the more godly the Jewish people behave, the more they are developing their Tzelem Elokim, the more they're emulating, the more they're imitating. Well, if that's true generally, says Malbim, it is especially true when it comes to the building of the Mishkan. When we talk about the Mishkan, haray, The building of the Mishkan represents in micro, essentially the creation of the world. That is why, it's the original microcosm. That's why when we rest from Malacha on Shabbos, if you think about it, which Malachas do we avoid? The Malachas that were involved in the making of the Mishkan. Why? In order to commemorate HaKadosh Baruch Hu resting, so to speak, from creating the world. Except, says Reb Chaim Mevolozhin, how does one thing lead to the other? How is one connected to the other? Hashem created the world with whatever he did. Bezalel made the Mishkan, however he did. How does resting from the Mishkan commemorate the creation of the world? Resting for creation of the world. Says Reb Chaim Mevolozhin in the Nefesh HaChaim, because the Mishkan is as close as we will get to a micro-representation of the world itself. And therefore, if we want to know in our experience which malachas are the world-creating malachas, they're the malachas of the Mishkan. That's where we learn malacha on Shabbos from. But of all the qualities, so to speak, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu creating the world, is certainly foremost amongst them. We don't really have that much scope to imitate that. But Bezalel did. In other words, if the Mishkan is a micro-representation of the world, then whoever makes the Mishkan essentially is imitating or emulating HaKadosh Baruch Hu in that creative process. And that brings us to the name Bezalel. And the Pasuk wants you to focus on the name. Because Bezalel, as the Gemara itself, divides it into essentially two words. Bezalel, Kael, the shadow of Hashem. And the shadow, says Malbim, really Tzel relates to the word Tzelem. Because as surely as Tzelem is a form, shadow also is a form. Shadow mirrors the form of, or represents the form of that which is in the shadow of. Which means Bezalel, Kael, Bezalel, his name really represents the level that he attained. Through being able to create the Mishkan, he attained this level, this aspect of Tzelem Elokim. And the Pasuk wants you to know from the outset, see how HaKadosh Baruch Hu has chosen him by name, because the name is fitting for him. He is Bezalel Kael, because he was the one. He will be the one who will be Bezalem Elokim as he creates the Mishkan, representing the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world. The pasuk continues to list Bezalel's qualities. Vayimaleos ruach Elokim, Hashem filled him with godly spirit. Bechachma v'tevuna v'das, with those three types of wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. Bechol malacha, he can basically do any project. Pasuk lamed beis v'lachashov machshavos, to think thoughts. La'asos ba'zahav uvakesef uvanachoshes. So I think we've worked hard in Parshanut this evening, so I'll conclude with a very interesting story that took place in Volozhin, and it related to the Meshulach, or one of the Meshulachim of the Volozhin Yeshiva. I think there was more than one. And he would go around and he'd collect from whoever he could collect from, and at a certain point, the Meshulach came back to Reb Chaim, the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, and said, he put in a request, and that is that he should be able to be dressed maybe a little bit more respectively, let's say, and his horse and wagon should be a little bit more balabatish, because he looks like such a nebuch, the way he is now, so that people see him, they give him a penny, but if he looks a little bit more respectable, then perhaps they'll give him more. And there's certain gevurim that he's thinking of visiting, so he wants to make a good impression. And that was his request. This is an expense account. And Reb Chaim agreed. And therefore he used some of the yeshiva's funds, and he bought some new clothes, and got a new horse, got a new wagon. He's all ready to visit the gevurim. He's decked out in the finest, the latest word in Lithuanian fashion. So he comes to one of the gevurim and he's looking for a good response. And the gevur gives him a pittance. Very deflated. And he comes back to the yeshiva with a bocious ponim. He gives over the small donation that he got and says, "I can't work it out." As Reb Chaim says, "Well, neither can I. I will go and visit him." So Reb Chaim of Volozhin, the Rosh Yeshiva, so he comes to visit the Gevir. So of course, the Gevir welcomes him in, Rosh Yeshiva. So Reb Chaim says, "To what do I owe the honor of this visit?" I have to ask. "You normally give a very substantial donation to the Yeshiva. We're very appreciative." And somehow everything went really to become a fraction of what that is now. So the Gevir says, "I'll tell you why. I believe in the Yeshiva, and I believe in the importance of learning Torah. So I give. But the most recent time this Meshulah came to me, he's got all these fancy clothes, and I looked at his horse, and I looked at his wagon, and I thought, well, that's where my money's going. I want to pay for the yeshiva, I don't want to pay for his horse. Did I minimize my donation? Was I wrong to do that?" So Reb Chaim said, "Look, you weren't wrong. because you want your money to go to the yeshiva. But you do need to appreciate, he does have a point. The more respectable he looks, it could be that the more ultimately that will bring in. It's an investment, but it's ultimately for the yeshiva. However, I have heard what you said, and I do respect it. And in fact, I'll tell you the following. And he opened up a chumash to this pasuk in Parshas Vayakel. And he said, let's take a look at how the Torah introduces Betzalel, beginning with pasuk Lamed, Kara Hashem B'Shem, he's Betzalel, Benuri Ben-Hur, and Pasuk Lamed Aleph begins to give us his qualifications and his credentials. Vayimaleh Yosef Ruach Elokim, full of godly spirit, V'chochma V'tvuna V'das, with those three capacities, Chochma V'tvuna V'das, in fact the Gemara says in Brachos and Daf Nun Hei, Betzalel knew the way in which the letters of the Aleph Beis were combined to create the world. And once again, he needs to know that because he's creating a miniature world of the Mishkan. So Bezalel, he's fully qualified. Uvechom alocha, he can do anything. Pasuk, next pasuk, v'lachshav machshavos, and he's able to think thoughts. La'asos bazahav v'kesev enachoshes, to know what to do with gold, silver, and copper. Says Reb Chaim, I have to tell you, in terms of parshanut, this final pasuk seems to be a bit of an anticlimax. You told me at the beginning, he knows Chochma, Tvuna, Vedas, Ruach Elokim, and what else? He thinks thoughts, you know, he has thoughts, what to do with the gold and so on. I should think so. I mean, how is that? Is this Malin Bakodesh? Is this a further? How is this in any way in excess of what we've already said? It seems to be very mild in comparison. So Reb Chaim said that Lemaisa, everyone gave to the Mishkan. But people are people. Not everyone gave in the same way, as if to say. The whole point of the donation really for the Mishkan is the amount of Lishem Shamayim, the Mishkan's got to be made Lishma. But we do also know, says Reb Chaim, that the Mishkan has different parts. Take gold, for example, or silver. Some of the gold was used to plate the Kroshim. Some of the gold was used for more external things. Some of the gold was used for the most internal thing there. For the Aron, the very Aron itself, the Kruvim and the Kaperes. And the Shaila is, was there any way of knowing which gold should be used for what? Which silver should be used for what? What should be one of perhaps the vessels for the courtyard? And what should be the basis for the Mishkan, etc. and so forth? So Chaim said, that's why it says, V'lachshav machshavos. After everything else, V'chochma v'tuno v'dah, Betzalel knew how to assess what to do with the gold, the silver, the copper, and all those other materials that were given to him. In other words, he was able to divine and discern from looking at those materials with what level of Lashem Shamayim and idealism and inspiration were they given. And based on that, he was able to say, this gold, that's high level Lashem Shamayim. That will go for the inner Caleb. This one, not so much. That goes for the intermediate. This one, less so, goes for the outside. And we see, therefore, that even Bezalel understood that the Mishkan needs everything. But whoever wants it to go for the highest, so then that's respected. And indeed, that's how it is. And therefore, says Reb Chaim, you should value and appreciate that the Meshulach does need to use money for these sorts of things. However, I have heard from you a higher level, as if to say, you specifically require that your money be only go for learning Torah and not for his suit or his wagon or his horse. I make a commitment to you that all the money you give, I'll personally see to it that it goes only for Torah study, not for any of the other things. And that was his balachshav machshavos here. So we leave our discussions of the Mishkan for the time being. Indeed, with Sefer Shemos, Chazak, Chazak, v'neschazek, and mitzvah Hashem. Next week we'll begin the first of our two sessions dealing with Pesach matters and Haggadah.